Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Movie Muse podcast. This episode, we are looking at that most enduring of cinematic genres, the disaster movie. Yes, from the day after tomorrow until when time ran out, myself and my fellow movie muses are going to be discussing the best and worst of all manner of apocalyptic catastrophes. Joining me, Graham, JD and Byatt, Mason, this month, we have Gordon, Sir Clive Sinclair.
Hello.
Simon Boggy Burton.
Hello.
And Matt Witchfinder Corn.
Hello.
So, that's the introductions done. Let's get on with the show. First up, a quick update on the Movie Muse website, www.moviemuse.net. First of all, a box set review of the Alien Quadrilogy, where we give our opinions on the four Alien movies. There's a review of the reboot, remake, sequel, whatever, of Ghostbusters. Plus, we've got a feature on the Zucker Brothers' famous comedy Airplane, where we attempt to count all the jokes up to find out just how many there are in this classic film. And there's all the usual regular roundup of free view movies as well, available each week. So head on over to www.moviemuse.net to check it all out. So on with the show. And what have we been watching? Which is where the Movie Muses give a rundown on a couple of movies they've seen lately. First up, I've got Simon.
Right, probably coming a bit late to the party, but I managed to watch Deadpool, which obviously a superhero film, very interesting. And what I liked about it was just the way it sort of jumped from different points. It starts at the end and then sort of jumps to the middle and goes all over the place, but then it all sort of ties in. And I like the comedy, the effects are good, the one-liners are cracking. It was just a romp from beginning to end, which is really enjoyable. And just even if you weren't into superheroes, it's just a really interesting film. I'll probably give it 4.5 out of 5, to be honest.
Cool.
The second one, which might surprise you a little bit, was I went through a few animated films, and one that I watched, which was a complete pleasant surprise, was the Angry Birds movie. Now, I played the game a little bit, don't find it particularly interesting, it was all right, got stuck in a few levels, gave up in the end, but I just quite liked the story, and you got the red bird who's the angry one, he doesn't get on with anybody, and his life's a bit bad, and it works up to the point where the pigs turn up, and then he ends up saving the day. But the thing is they shoehorn the actual game in pretty well as well, it's sort of the final assault kind of bits and pieces of it, I won't go into too much detail, but yeah, they tie in the game and have a reasonably good story, and get to actually quite like the character. So I went in there completely thinking it wasn't going to be very good, wasn't going to be interesting, just another cash in on a game. But actually, you know what? It turned out to be a lot better than I thought. I'd give it 3.5 out of 5. I'd probably, if I watched it again, I may even up to 4. But yeah, I did actually quite enjoy it, surprisingly.
Okay, fair enough. So a few good words for the Angry Birds movie there. Matt, what have you been watching lately?
Well, there's something I watched just the other day. I recorded it off the TV, and the main reason I watched it was because it starred Anton Yelchin, who tragically died a few weeks ago, having bizarrely been crushed to death by his own car in a freak accident. The film's called Odd Thomas. It's a 2013 supernatural comedy thriller, and he plays the title character, whose name is actually Odd Thomas, due to an error when his birth was registered. He was supposed to be called Todd Thomas, but they got his name wrong. He's got a psychic gift where he can see people who've been killed, and these people help him track down their own killers, who he then reports to the police. And there's a horde of supernatural creatures called Bodaks, which descend upon his little town that he lives in. And he knows that these mean that there's going to be a disastrous event about to take place. These creatures don't actually cause the chaos, but they sort of feed off it. So the rest of the film then follows him looking into and trying to prevent this disaster. It's based on a Dean Koontz novel and directed by Stephen Sommers, who is most famous for the Mummy films and also Van Helsing. And this film definitely has some of the hallmarks from those films. There's quite a bit of CGI in there, and obviously it's got a sort of horror supernatural theme again, like Van Helsing. It's a bit of a mixed bag. I think Yelchin was very good in it. He's well cast as a sort of quirky main character, and also got Willem Dafoe in it as the police chief that is in on Yelchin's character's secret. The villains, though, were pretty nondescript. Can't really remember anything notable about them. And there are a few good action scenes, but there's also large parts of the film that are a bit messy and unnecessary. And the actress who plays his girlfriend, Addison Timlin, she is way too hot for his character. She's, like, way out of his league and basically spends most of the film wearing really small shorts, which I'm not really complaining about, but seems a bit impractical for the situation that they're finding themselves in. It is quite funny. It's got a line early in the film where he says, "I might see dead people, but then by God, I do something about it," which is obviously a bit of a dig at The Sixth Sense. And without giving too much away, the ending of it is quite sad, and probably even more so given what happened to the lead actor. This film totally bombed at the box office. It didn't even make like $1 million, I don't think. And that was in part due to some legal disputes with the distributors. But it's not a bad film. It would have benefited a bit from better editing. I'm going to give that 3 stars. Another film I watched recently, also from 2013, was White House Down. This is the other White House taken over by terrorist film competing with Olympus Has Fallen, which came out a few months earlier. This has got Jamie Foxx as the president and Channing Tatum as the hero tasked with saving him when terrorists take over the White House, and they're led by a traitorous Secret Service director played by James Woods. There's also a side issue in that Channing Tatum's character's daughter is trapped in the building, so he's got to keep an eye on her as well. And Olympus Has Fallen, I recall, was quite frequently described as Die Hard in the White House, but this film is way more like Die Hard. There's scenes where the heroes are hiding in elevator shafts, there's a helicopter gets blown up on the roof of the White House, and Channing Tatum even runs around in his vest for most of the film, so he's not even trying to hide the sort of similarities to Die Hard. Channing Tatum's perfectly functional as the brainless action hero, but Jamie Foxx is a bit miscast as the president, as he's way too young and has no aura of importance or dignity about him. There's a character introduced early on that you immediately suspect is going to be up to no good, and although he seems to be a good guy, sure enough he's revealed right at the end to be the mastermind of the attack during the final 10 minutes. And the action sequences are mostly exciting, but nothing that hasn't been done 100 times before. It's not a bad film, it's enjoyably silly, but it's really predictable action movie by numbers. Nowhere near as good as Olympus Has Fallen, so I'm going to give that 2 stars.
Okay, I went through a phase of watching a lot of Dean Koontz adaptations, and generally over the years a lot of them have been straight to video, so I'm quite surprised that Odd Thomas got even a theatrical release, to be honest. But I think Odd Thomas is one of Dean Koontz's better novels, but I just think a lot of his novels don't really translate particularly well to the screen. So there's a few good ones, but I think generally his novels just don't make good films, so that's probably why a lot of them don't do too well.
Yeah, I'm a fan of a few Dean Koontz books. I've not seen Odd Thomas, but that one just sounds far too much Buffy the Vampire Slayer to me.
It was a little bit more like Ghostbusters, I would say. It was a cross between The Sixth Sense and Ghostbusters, although the ghosts can't talk to him. They can only sort of point in the direction of who killed them and all that kind of stuff. So he can see dead people, they interact with him, but he can't talk to them. So that's kind of interesting.
I think part of the problem is that he's so prolific, Dean Koontz, that a lot of the books are very similar as well. So you read a book like Odd Thomas and a lot of it just seems so familiar from his other novels. You know, it's just obviously he can't help repeating himself. He's written so many novels. I mean, he's still writing bestsellers, so he must be doing something right, but a lot of it just kind of fades into one for me anyway with his work. Well, thanks, Matt, for that update on what you've been watching. Gordon?
Well, as well as the Movie Muse Film Club, I'm also in a film club at work, and I was pointed in the direction of a subgenre of movies that might interest me, and it's called mumblecore, and I don't know if any of you have heard of the subgenre itself or of the films that are included in it, but basically, very dialogue-heavy films, usually black or bleak comedies, usually low-budget, usually with a thin or non-existent plot, and usually with a pretty unknown cast. So it's a genre that's probably not for everyone, but I've been watching quite a few of the films that fit into this genre, and it really suits what I like to get out of a film. So there's no action, nothing happens in most of them, and anyone who's seen the sitcom Seinfeld that is billed as the comedy about nothing, which is my favourite American TV show, it kind of fits with that the dialogue and the friendship and the relationships that are built up are kind of what drags me through these films. So a few recommendations I'd give of films from the mumblecore genre. One of them's called The Puffy Chair, and that's about a road trip to collect a chair that's been bought on eBay. And it is as simple as that. They just get in a car and go off and drive to collect this chair. But little things happen along the way, but nothing mind-blowing. But it's the relationships and the conversations that they have that are really good. There's one called Drinking Buddies, which is a relationship drama about two friends who work at a brewery together. And then there's another one called Me, You and Everyone We Know, about the lives of a separated father and a lonely artist that he meets through his job and how their lives entwine. And it's hard to explain what I like about mumblecore, because it's pretty much nothing happens. It's like putting a camera on real life, but I really enjoyed it, and I've seen about 6 or 7 films in that style, and they're really good. So I'd recommend people at least look up the term mumblecore and see if any of the films that they've already seen are listed in there. The other film that I wanted to mention was The Purge, Election Year. The original Purge was an unexpected massive box office hit. I think it was done on a budget for about $8 million and made somewhere in the region of $130 million or something like that. It was a massive, massive success. So it's no surprise that they continue doing sequels. And it's based on the premise that a new government is formed in the US called the New Founding Fathers. And they introduce a law that basically says that for 12 hours every year, this particular day, all crime is legal. So basically, you can go out and kill anyone you like, and the law can do nothing about it. And the first Purge film was very much a home invasion. So it's a bit like Panic Room, people trying to save themselves within their own home with hordes of people out to get them. And then the second film, Anarchy, was more of a journey through hell. So it was A to B through all kinds of horrors. So it was very much in a similar kind of style to The Warriors. And the third film, I think, has tried to do a bit of both, but then add a little bit of political commentary in there as well. I mean, obviously, it's called Election Year, so there's going to be some stuff about elections. And it's trying to talk about the morality of whether the Purge is a good idea or whether it's actually just a way of culling poor people. And they probably overdo that political side a little bit too much. I think they undersell some of the tension and some of the action. And they spend too much money and time on flash costumes of these people who are going out to purge. So it's turned into a bit of a Halloween now, but Halloween where people get dressed up and go out and murder. I don't think Election Year is a highlight of the series. The films probably get worse as they go on, but I still really enjoyed it. And as a trilogy, I'd recommend people go watch all three because they do fit together really well and actually come to a conclusion. So, you know, we're not, or it's very unlikely we're going to see a Purge 4 unless they reinvent it like they've done with lots of other horror films. So for Purge Election Year, I'd probably give it 3 out of 5.
I've watched the first two Purge films. The second one reminded me a lot of a John Carpenter film. It's a bit like Escape from New York in that they're trying to get from one place to the other and there's lots of people trying to kill them. And it's also very dark and, you know, they're running through the streets and all that kind of stuff. And the music, I thought, was quite reminiscent of the sort of electronic stuff that Carpenter's well famous for. But it wasn't as good as the first one. I'm interested to hear that they've rounded the series off because I think there's potential for all kinds of films to be set in that premise of there's 12 hours and you can do whatever you like. And they've kind of focused on people killing each other, but there could be all kinds of other crime that people could be committing, you know, and interacting with one another, people committing different crimes for different reasons. So it could go on for like numerous more episodes, but maybe they've realized that they've kind of done the best they can with it now.
Yeah, and I think they've not closed off completely, but they've closed this trilogy. The trilogy comes to a neat end, and I applaud them for that because there's nothing worse than keeping everything open-ended and never getting a resolution.
Thank you, Gordon. Finally, myself, I've watched recently for my latest feature for Retro Gamers, License to Thrill section, which is a regular section in the magazine which highlights games based on popular movies. Following on from RoboCop and Cobra, we had another 80s hit in Top Gun, famous Tom Cruise movie from 1986. I have to say, I've not seen it since the 80s, and it's dated pretty horribly. The gung-ho flight sequences just don't have the impact today that they had 30-odd years ago. And I'm also not sure if the filmmakers intended it or not, but as has been said many times since, there's a very obvious homoerotic tone throughout the whole movie, which is quite bizarre, really. I'm sure that perhaps they didn't mean it to be that way, but it just paints the movie in a very strange light. But a lot of the dialogue throughout Top Gun is cringeworthy, really, and although it's still enjoyable in kind of an 80s nostalgic way, I didn't really enjoy the movie or the game actually for that much. So I would give Top Gun 2 out of 5 now. Any of you guys watched Top Gun lately?
Yeah, I watched Top Gun within the last few months. And whilst I agree it's aged not fantastically, you have to watch it with your 80s head on. And I agree that there's a very strong homoerotic tone. But I can't agree that the flight scenes aren't just as exciting now as they were then.
I thought they looked exactly what they were. They've just filmed a few jets in the air one morning and that's about it.
You're harder to please than me.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you, Graham, that it's not aged particularly well, but I don't even think I liked it that much when I was younger either. I'd never call it like one of my top 10 80s action films or whatever kind of film you want to say. The bits I like most in it are the cheesy bits, like where they're singing the songs and all the cheesy lines and all that kind of stuff. The romance between Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis was kind of embarrassing even then. It wasn't very believable, so yeah, it was only ever a 3 out of 5 film for me anyway.
Surely Simon's got something to say about Top Gun, seeing as he chose it as the soundtrack of one of the shows.
Oh, I agree it's aged, but I still think it's really good. Still like flight scenes. But you, Gordon, I still think they're exciting. I still like it when Maverick goes through the jet wash and has to overcome his demons and get him out of it. All right, yeah, and it is homoerotic. Val Kilmer looks like he's straight out of a game porn mag. But yeah, I still think it's pretty all right. And as you say, watch it with your 80s head on and just enjoy it for what it is.
Okay. And the second, it's not a film I've watched, but it does relate quite closely to a film that we've discussed recently. But I watched a Doctor Who story called The Day of the Daleks, which has an intriguing plot. It's a John Pertwee story, and it's set in both the modern day, which obviously at the time was the 70s, and the future. The Daleks have taken over the world in the future by killing a bunch of world leaders in present day. And rebels from the future are coming back in time to try and stop this happening. I'm sure one of you guys can tell me which movie that sounds familiar to.
A bit Terminator-ish.
It is the Terminator, yeah. They're going back in time to try and change time. Only it is actually a little bit cleverer than the Terminator in the resolution and how it all happens. It's a bit of a time-twisting brain number, to be quite honest with you, and I'm not really sure it works, but in my opinion, it's one of the better Doctor Who John Pertwee stories. And it's very enjoyable, and as I say, if you're a fan of the Terminator movies, I think you get a lot of enjoyment out of it because the plot is quite similar. And also, I watched the version that's had the special effects improved as well. I'm not really sure it worked, but the special effects were a little bit better than they were in the 70s. So yeah, I watched The Day of the Daleks, and I give that 4 out of 5. Okay, next up we've got What Have We Been Watching, the Wags edition. This is where one of our wives or girlfriends picks a movie for us to watch. The idea of this was to introduce us to some movies that perhaps we wouldn't watch. Last time out, my girlfriend Ruth chose Mean Girls, which didn't go down particularly well with most of us. And Matt's other half, Anna, for this podcast, she chose American History X. Matt, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the film before we go into it further?
So, American History X, Edward Norton plays the leader of a white supremacist gang in Venice Beach, California, who is sent to prison for killing two black men that tried to steal his car. By the time he's released, he's seen the error of his ways, but finds that his younger brother, played by Edward Furlong, is following the same neo-Nazi path that he did, and he must deal with the former gang and the repercussions of his own actions years earlier. The story is told through scenes in the present day, which are shown in colour, and then there's also flashbacks to previous events during the life of the characters, which are done in black and white. As to what I thought about it, it's powerful, but it's certainly grim and depressing stuff. It's got some occasionally sickening violence, particularly the scene where he disposes of one of the two people that's trying to steal his car. There's no doubting, though, that it's a very well-made film, and the acting from everyone involved is top-notch, I think. Edward Norton is excellent, as always. I don't think he does any bad films, particularly. And Edward Furlong, I think, gives a career-best performance as well. And it's also got a really good supporting cast, particularly, I thought, Fairuza Balk, who plays Edward Norton's terrifying girlfriend. She's scary in everything she does, but she's particularly scary in this. When we watched it a few weeks ago, I found it particularly relevant at that moment in time because there seems to be a rise of racial intolerance in this country, prompted somewhat by the Leave vote in the EU referendum. And I think some of the Britain First idiots would do well to watch this, or they probably missed the point that hatred won't make your life better, and actually just use it as inspiration for their cause. Ultimately, not an enjoyable film by any means, but certainly an excellent film, and I'd give it 4 stars, but I'll almost certainly never watch it again.
Thank you, Matt. Gordon, what did you think of American History X?
Very similar to Matt. It's got a pretty brutal and hard-hitting start to the film, particularly the murder that Matt mentioned, the sickening murder, and which definitely stuck with me. But it then kind of slow burns into this thoughtful film with a moralistic ending. And that kind of putting everything up front and then slowing down for the rest of the film doesn't make for an exciting movie. But what it does do is it serves the narrative so much better than if it had kept the pace up throughout. As Matt said, performances are fantastic. I'd call out Stacey Keach as another one of the excellent performances there as the Nazi group's leader. I recently watched Green Room with Anton Yelchin, and that has got a very similar part of this white supremacist leader played by Patrick Stewart. And I was watching Patrick Stewart play this role and thinking he must have watched American History X just before he went in to film this, because he plays the part almost exactly the same. And I think that's a great legacy of these great actors that you're seeing do contemporary performances that immediately make you think of performances from a good 15 years ago or so. So yeah, I think it's a fantastic film. Not exciting or enjoyable, but it's thought-provoking. And I'd also give it 4 stars, but I probably will watch it again.
Thank you, Gordon. I tend to agree with that, and I'd isolate one comment you made there, which is about it being a slow burn movie, because whilst, with a few notable exceptions, not a great deal actually happens in the movie, it is a film that is hard to take your eyes off, really, because of the way the characters are, obviously the way it's acted, which is very well. And also, I think the quality of the script, I'm a big fan of Ed Norton, and the story, obviously a powerful one, kind of a redemption story. I did find the redemption he underwent in prison a little bit unrealistic. You know, he's got a lot of anger, and what happened to him in prison, you would have thought would make him even more angry and maybe make him not so much of a neo-Nazi, but angry in another direction. And his character comes out of prison and almost seems to be in a trance-like state most of the time and completely at peace, which didn't quite sit well with me. But nevertheless, it's obviously the arc is that his brother has fallen into the same trap as him. And I think also the ending was fairly well signalled throughout the movie, but that didn't bother me in particularly because it's so well acted and the movie is such a high quality and it's got such a powerful message that really it's about that rather than the actual ending. So I think it was a little bit disappointing in that respect, mainly because it's a movie that came out 20 years ago almost, and I've been waiting to watch it for that long, so I was very intrigued about it and maybe just a little bit disappointed. But I still enjoyed it a great deal, and I would probably not watch it again like Matt, but I would give it 3.5 stars out of 5. That just leaves you, Simon.
I think you've all pretty much covered most of what the film's about. I know you say you can't enjoy the film because what it is, I actually quite enjoy it, but it is a very well-made film, very gritty, hard-hitting, violent, even right from the beginning. I quite like the flashback idea, the black and white, and the way the story knits together. And it's all very poignant. I know you said it doesn't sit with you well that he came out of prison, Graham, that, and it just seemed too easy for him to be in redemption. But it did make you question humanity in the way people's penchant to be like sheep, to follow an ideal, almost the brainwashing levels. But something may change that, and it sort of points to the fact there is good in most people irrespective of their past, and they can change for the better. And even it may take something pretty drastic. I mean, that scene in the prison was pretty bad, but the way you got on with the black guy, I actually quite like that. It actually gave me a good feeling, the way they were eventually getting on. The only thing that I found really poignant about it is that the life he chose to follow before prison, and when he came out, and the way he led his life does not let them go even when they wanted to. So he came out redemption, but he was still couldn't get away from that life. And then the way what happens to his brother, and you don't know from that point whether he leads him back into something else, or you say the anger just gets channeled somewhere else, or he does just see it as that's happened, I have to move on. So yeah, left a bit of questions, but it's up to you to make your own mind up. And yeah, I thought it was a good film. Go for 4 stars out of 5.
I think that's quite interesting what you're saying there, Simon, and I think tying it back to what Matt said about the rising kind of racial issues in the country at the moment, the stuff that you see about Ed Norton's dad in the film, what I read from that is that his father had this political view that then Ed Norton, through Stacey Keach and through the Nazi group, took to a completely different level. And I think that's what's happened in this country with, you know, with a lot of the far-right political groups are just feeding these people who are naturally going to take things to the next level. And I thought the film did a really good job of showing that almost subliminally. It's one of those films that when you talk about it, you actually start to think it's even better than when you'd just watched it in isolation.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, the theme of the film is violence against non-whites. I found it quite interesting how, whether black or white, there are a few exceptions, but there aren't really many good characters of either colour in the film. There's obviously the scene that happens at the end, and that was quite interesting, that it didn't try to paint any particular group in a particular light, but obviously tried to show that the violence, whatever it was wrong. I don't know if this is true, this is just what it says on IMDb, that the ending in the film as it is like Simon says, it's left open to interpretation. What happens at the end? Does he go back to being a neo-Nazi, or does he continue his new life? And the original ending gave no doubt as to what happened and the path that Ed Norton's character then took. But I believe that Ed Norton himself objected, and I think probably that was a good idea to leave it open-minded for the audiences to make up their own mind as to what happened next. Well, thank you guys for that anyway, and thank you, Anna, for that choice. The score for American History X is 3.9, which puts it...
Well, it's first, obviously.
It's going to be above Mean Girls, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that got 2.1.
Yeah, we were a bit generous that night, weren't we?
Simon was. That reminds me, can I just bring up the point that Simon gave Mean Girls 3 out of 5, which is the same score, I believe, that he gave The Force Awakens? Can I just leave that there for a moment?
Yeah, I think he gave 1 point for each of Lindsay Lohan's boobs, though, didn't he?
Well, that was exactly it, of course.
Next month, it is Simon's better half, Jackie's choice. So, Simon, what's Jackie gone for?
Jackie's gone for Leon, which is a 1994 English language but French action crime thriller. It stars Jean Reno and Gary Oldman. It features the first motion picture debut of Natalie Portman. In the film, Reno plays a professional hitman. He reluctantly takes the 12-year-old Matilda, which is Natalie Portman's character, under his wing after her family is murdered by the corrupt Drug Enforcement Administration agent, played by Gary Oldman. It's a film that's been on my list. I think my friend sent it to me about 15 years ago, and I haven't watched it. He gave me back the DVD probably about 4 years later. Still hadn't watched it. I still haven't seen it, so I'm actually quite looking forward to it, to be honest.
Okay. Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Jackie. On to our next section, which is coming soon. We're now going to go around our table and see which particular movie each of the movie viewers is looking forward to. So firstly, Simon, what's coming up in the next couple of months that you're looking forward to?
I've seen a film that's coming up, which I didn't know about, and coming out towards the end of August. It's an adult-themed animated film, and it's called Sausage Party. It's a film that follows a sausage who tries to discover his existence and goes on a journey with his friends to escape their fate. Frank, who is voiced by Seth Rogen, is a sausage. Brenda, voiced by Kristen Wiig, is a hot dog bun. They can't wait to go home with what they think is going to be a happy customer and live a happy life. Soon, their world comes crashing down as poor Frank learns the horrifying truth that he will eventually become a meal. After warning his pals about their similar fate, the panicked perishables devise a plan to escape from their human enemies. It's a parody, apparently, of a Disney Pixar type film. Quite look forward to something a bit silly like that, to be honest.
Yeah, I must admit, I saw that trailer, and the first time I watched it, I found it hilarious, but I do worry that after the initial revelation at the beginning, there's not really a lot to the movie after that, and it won't sustain the laughs, but hopefully it'll be proved wrong, but certainly I want to see it. Unfortunately, my kids want to see it as well, but there's absolutely no chance of that happening. But...
Yeah, there was a bit of controversy as well, that a cinema chain in America, I think it was, played the trailer, which was certainly not safe for young children, just before the Zootopia showings. That didn't go down too well with the ultra-right-wing American Mother's Brigade.
Gordon, what are you looking forward to?
I've chosen War Dogs, starring Jonah Hill and Miles Teller. It's a story of two 20-something friends in Miami who exploit a government initiative to bid on US military contracts and end up securing a £300 million deal to arm the Afghan army, which sounds completely stupid, but is incredibly based on a true story. And it's directed by the guy who did the Hangover films, so it's full of laughs and action. Trailers look very funny. They look very interesting as well. It looks like a story that, because there's some truth in it, I'll be interested to see how it unfolds. But it does look very funny and very well played by the two lead actors, judging on the two trailers I've seen so far. It's in cinemas from 26th of August, so I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you, Gordon. I'm looking forward in particular to another superhero movie, as usual, but this one is a bit more low-key. It's the cinematic adaptation of Doctor Strange, starring Benedict Cumberbatch in the lead role.
Graham, I'm confused. Is it Doctor Strange or is it low-key?
Oh, God.
The big multi-star extravaganzas, I feel they do need a counterpoint, and this is provided by some of these other movies. The popularity of superheroes is so high at the moment that these can be made as well, which I think is a good thing. Ant-Man, I found, was a particularly good movie, and it proved to the studios as well that these smaller characters could have big movies of their own, if you excuse the pun. And I think Doctor Strange, from the trailers, looks like it's going to be more of a supernatural twist on the superhero story, but it certainly looks like it's going to be an excellent, well-produced film, so I'm looking forward to that in particular. And Doctor Strange is out on the 28th of October in the UK. Finally, Matt, you've got the trailer choice this episode, so what are we watching?
I've gone for the trailer which came out recently for a film based on a novel by an author called M.R. Carey, which tells the story of a dystopian future where much of the population has been infected by a mutation of the Cordyceps fungus and become zombie-like drones wandering around, called Hungries, I believe. And it stars Gemma Arterton as a school teacher that embarks on a perilous journey in this world to save a special young girl called Melanie. And the reason I chose this is twofold. The first reason is that this film, which is called, by the way, The Girl with All the Gifts, it is based on the book of the same name, as I mentioned, and Simon, on our very first podcast back in November last year, was reading that book, so I thought he might be interested to see the trailer for the film. And also, the second reason is because some of the scenes from the film were shot in the old bus station of my local city centre, up Hanleyduck. So I thought for that reason it was of particular interest to at least myself and Simon. The release date is the 23rd of September, so shall we have a look at the trailer?
Okay, run VT.
Shine, come on up you get. Transit.
Hello, Dr. Caldwell.
Hello, Melanie.
morning, class.
Good morning, Miss Justina.
Once upon a time, there was a woman. The most beautiful and amazing woman in all the world.
No! You just touched her. Watch.
No, please, don't do that. They're only children. Stop it! One day, she was attacked by a monster. But then a girl came running up and killed it. And the woman said, "You are my special girl, and I'll never let you go."
She saved me, and you're still afraid of her?
Yeah, and you should be too.
I am producing a vaccine, and she is the main ingredient.
What am I?
Hope.
That's what you are.
I just want to live. Everyone wants that.
She loves you. The hell is this?
The world is falling apart. You can save people, Melanie. You can save everybody. Oh my God.
Go, go.
What did you do?
Right, so that's the trailer for The Girl with All the Gifts. What do we think, Gordon?
Well, to be honest, I'm so over the zombie apocalypse that I'm just desperate for somebody to do something different with a zombie film. And it's not just films, it's video games, it's books, it's everything. The zombie apocalypse has just taken over the world and I'm sick of it. The only film that's ever done anything in the last 5 years that's stopped me and made me think, actually, that's good, well done, was Maggie, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film that most of us watched not that long ago. And this seems somewhere between a zombie film and Maggie, in that it seems slower, it seems more thoughtful. So I'm hopeful for it. I still think it'll be just too much of another zombie film for me, but I'm hopeful. I thought the trailer was interesting.
Thank you, Gordon. Simon, what are your thoughts?
I think that looks like it's sticking very, very closely to the story. I think, Gordon, I think there's a thing about the zombies in this which might surprise you. It might make it that different thing that you might find pretty good. There's a lot of other back parts of the story, and why it's happened is very interesting when you find out, and the ending is excellent. It's looking like it's going to be very close to the book, which I hope it does. The story was really good, and I think if it sticks to it, this adaptation is going to be pretty spot on. So, yeah, definitely looking forward to it.
The author wrote the screenplay at the same time as writing the book, apparently. So from how he's described it, it's telling the same story from a slightly different perspective.
I think that's a really good experiment, because I'm not aware of many other films where they've done that and written it as a novel and as a film at the same time. I think that'd be really interesting to see how that works. I'm not going to read the book, but Simon, I'll be interested to see how that works when it comes out.
Thank you, guys. I kind of agree with Gordon. I think we're approaching saturation point with this type of movies, but having seen the trailer, it does seem to be trying to do something a little bit different, so I am holding hopes that this will be an entertaining and thought-provoking movie as well.
I have to say, I'm not that impressed by the trailer. I chose it, but not because I think it looks like a brilliant film. I chose it because it was partially filmed in my hometown, and because Simon read the book of it, so I thought he might be interested.
Yeah,
it looks kind of dull, and I always worry about films that are trying to do something on quite a grand scale that are produced in Britain, because they don't generally pull it off.
Well, about 28 Days Later, that did it.
Yeah, but they're not the big scale films. It just seems like they're trying to do something maybe like World War Z or whatever you want to call it, but with a smaller budget and a British cast. So I don't know, I'm not really convinced by the trailer. I will watch it at some point because I want to see if I can spot my old bus station. I think I spotted it in the trailer, but I don't think I'll go and watch it at the cinema.
Well, thank you, guys. That was The Girl with All the Gifts, and what else we are looking forward to. Next up is our film club. Last episode, Matt chose the Jackie Chan movie Project A. Matt, can you tell us a bit about Project A and what you think of the film?
Project A is a 1983 film which Jackie Chan wrote, directed and starred in. The film's set in the late 19th century Hong Kong, and he plays Dragon Ma, a sergeant in the Coast Guard who are having problems dealing with a fleet of pirates. He eventually teams up with Inspector Tin Su of the Hong Kong Police, played by Yuen Biao, and a small-time thief and friend called Fei, played by Sammo Hung, to infiltrate the pirates' lair and bring them down from the inside. To me, it's one of the best Hong Kong action films, a great mix of action, comedy and martial arts with some spectacular stunts. In particular, my favourite scene is the cycling scene where he fends off a number of attackers whilst riding a bicycle. To me, that's one of the best action sequences in all of cinema, not just in Hong Kong cinema. And it's not just the slapstick humour that's funny, but even the dialogue's actually quite funny, although the punchlines are sometimes given away by the subtitles, not keeping time with the speech. There's some other great scenes as well. The barroom brawl at the beginning of the film is done in time to music, and that's really good. And there's also the clock tower fall, which is a tribute to the work of silent movie star Harold Lloyd, who did the same scene in the film Safety Last. There's a sequel actually to Project A, which creates another memorable silent movie stunt, which is the collapsing front of a building, which is a famous Buster Keaton scene. My only criticism really of the film is that the best action scenes take place in the first half of the film, and it runs out of steam a little bit in the final half hour. But overall, I think it's a brilliant film. As I've mentioned previously, my favourite Jackie Chan film, better than anything he did when he came to Hollywood. So as a Hong Kong action film, it's a 5-star film, but it's 4 stars in the wider movie world from me.
Thanks for that, Matt. One of your favourites then. So let's ask Simon what he thought of Project A.
Overall, I liked it. I wasn't sure at the start, but in the first 10 minutes, it suddenly just erupts into the ballroom brawl, and I just found that hilarious. I just loved the action in it. It did bring back the old slapstick-type comedies from the past. It was good humour. There was lots of chop-socky action, obviously. The two initial adversaries teaming up to take down Mr. Big. The dialogue was good, you know, obviously with the subtitles, but I think it was funny. It was seemed to be well written. And the fact it was subtitled made it more enjoyable for some actually than being dubbed, I must admit. I preferred it that way. And do you know what? I know this sounds crazy, but it was like watching Monkey the movie, just without the magic and the fantasy, but same kind of humour and fight routines, just no magic cloud to fly about on. And I'd give it 3.5 out of 5.
Thank you, Simon. Yeah, I was going to add that comment as well. It did seem to me to have echoes of that TV series as well. This is the first non-American Jackie Chan movie that I've ever seen. Not a big fan of his American output, apart from maybe The Cannonball Run, which I don't think he was really a big star of. I watched this, and I must admit I hated the first 10 minutes until it got to the bar fight. And then that scene, which Matt's already pointed out, kind of won me over. There's one joke in particular where, just before this fight, one of the bad guys, he pours a drink over Jackie Chan's head. And Jackie Chan says to him, "We've got two ways we can resolve this. Either you say sorry." And before he's had a chance to say the second way, the guy says, "I'll take the second way," because obviously he has no intention of saying sorry whatsoever. And that sort of like instigates this big fight. And there's actually quite a lot of clever wordplay throughout it, which I found quite enjoyable. And as Matt has already suggested as well, all the standout scenes also I found very entertaining. So if this is the best Jackie Chan Hong Kong movie, then I've probably started at the wrong point, because I've started off with the best one. But it's certainly an entertaining film. It moves along at a really fast pace and doesn't let up for any of its hour and 30 minutes or whatever it is. And like Simon says, it's a bit like the TV series Monkey. And I would say the TV series Monkey crossed with Carry On film stroke Jackie Chan type movie. And it's as entertaining as I would expect that to be. So yeah, I enjoyed this a lot. Thank you for choosing it, Matt. And I give it 4 out of 5. Gordon?
I think I agree with everybody who said that the first 10 minutes were a bit slow, because it darted off and I thought it was just a standard Hong Kong martial arts comedy with nothing new to add. But then the nods to classic Hollywood and some great, really unrefined fight sequences, including the brutal end fight, rise it above the norm. And whilst I don't think it's as good as some of his later films, I think something like Shanghai Noon is much better than this. I still really enjoyed it, and I'd give it 3 out of 5.
Thank you, Gordon. That gives Project A a score of 3.625.
Which puts it third on the leaderboard.
Third on the leaderboard for Project A.
What's above it?
We've got Cop Car in first place, Coherence in second, and then we have Project A and then Reanimator.
Next episode, it will be Simon's choice for Film Club. Simon, tell us about what you've got in mind and where listeners can obtain it from.
Thanks, Graham. My Film Club choice is a 1996 American crime comedy film directed by Wes Anderson, and it's called Bottle Rocket. I saw this years and years ago. Owen and Luke Wilson, obviously the brothers acting together. James Caan is in it, and it's just about, he gets released from mental hospital following a nervous breakdown, and they team up, pull off one particular crime job, and then they go after their boss, a guy called the legendary Mr. Henry, and they just literally hit the road, and the ensuing escapade, it turns out to be far from what anyone expected. There's a lot of twists and turns at the end. So, because it's quite old now, obviously over 20 years, it's available on Amazon, purchased off of YouTube and Google Play. Prices ranging from about £1 to about a fiver, I suppose. So yeah, my choice is 1996 film Bottle Rocket.
Okay, thank you very much, Simon. Sounds an interesting choice. Let's watch the trailer for Bottle Rocket.
Preparation was good, you know. I think that's your specialty.
Thank you, because if I said that one, it would sound like bragging. Obviously good quickness.
Yeah, in and out pretty fast.
Real fast. Including the coin collection and the earrings.
You took the earrings, Dignan?
I bought the earrings for my mother on her birthday.
Maybe we should have robbed your house. You ever think of that?
Three outstanding young men.
Well, come on, baby, and rock with me tonight.
Bob Mapplethorpe, potential getaway driver.
Go. I really want to be a part of this team. And I'm the only one with a car. That's good. That's good. Because that hits me right here.
I'm Anthony. You speak English?
It's amazing how close you can get to a girl when you're not allowed to talk to her.
And my name's Dignan, man.
You in the army, yes?
No, I just have short hair.
We are a team.
Dignan, I can't focus unless the gun is on the table.
We just paid for it.
Shut up, man.
We don't settle our problems with pugs, man. We settle them with bare knuckles.
All they ever wanted was to be wanted.
What are you putting that tape on your nose for?
Exactly.
Let's get lucky. Just do exactly as I say. Let's move. Come on.
Get one of those bags.
A bigger one, you idiot. What do you think?
Don't call me an idiot, you punk.
Do you have bigger bags for atlases or dictionaries, sir?
I'll tell you something, kid. You got the guts of a damn lion.
That is Mr. Henry.
Hey, Henry, how are you?
He is a very talented thief.
Hey!
Just kidding.
I don't know. Are you in?
I really don't want to do this robbery, you know.
Man, neither do I.
You're breaking his heart. You know that, don't you?
What were you thinking?
They're gonna keep on trying.
Got it, ma'am. We know it backwards and we know it forwards because we've done the legwork and we've done the research.
Until they get it right.
What are you doing here? You're always at lunch now.
Not always.
Yes, always.
Bob?
Hey!
Stop, go, stop, go.
On the run from Johnny Law.
Did he give you the keys? Did he give you the keys?
Pole vaulting, laughing gas, choppers. Can you see how incredible this is going to be? Excuse me. Are the explosives really necessary?
So that concludes the preliminaries. Now we're on to the main topic, which is disaster movies. Grab the dog. This has been a staple of Hollywood since its very beginning. Some of the earliest silent movies, such as The General, featured spectacular crashes, usually trains, that wowed audiences unused to such spectacles. By the time the 1950s and 60s arrived, special effects had improved, and the world's fear of nuclear weapons instilled a new breed of disaster movie, fueled by the possibility of nuclear Armageddon and its grim consequences. But it wasn't until the 70s that the disaster movie entered popular culture as a genuine genre, thanks most notably to the master of disaster, Irwin Allen, and also a whole series of aviation disaster movies, starting with 1970's Airport, most of which were based on hit novels by Arthur Haley. The template was set here, with Haley's original Airport novel containing multiple characters, each dealing with adversity in their own way, and ensuring many of the movies throughout the 70s became known as much for their all-star casts as the disasters themselves. After a relatively quiet decade in the 80s, the mid-90s saw a dramatic resurgence of the disaster movie genre as special effects improved measurably. In came CGI, and with it a swathe of films such as Twister, Dante's Peak, Volcano, Armageddon, and Deep Impact, along of course with one of the most famous maritime disasters of all time, and a massive cinematic hit, Titanic. Like it or loathe it, the disaster movie was back with a bang, and we've been treated to regular, massive event movies of this ilk ever since. Disaster movies can take on many forms, but there is one constant that runs through them, man. Every disaster movie involves man versus a seemingly unsurmountable threat of some kind. So for this episode, we are looking at each of the challenges man faces and the notable movies from each one. But first, let's talk disaster movies in general, and I'm going to put a couple of questions to my fellow movie musers. The first question I'm going to ask is what they think makes a good disaster movie. I've got some thoughts about this myself, but first of all, I'm going to ask Gordon.
I've got a theory to share about disaster movies that might be a little bit more intellectual than you was expecting. I can't claim it as my own theory. I was recently training for a qualification at work. It was kind of a 5-day course, and the trainer was telling us about his theory about disaster movies, which is quite odd, seeing as it was a project management course. So how we got into disaster movies, I'm not sure. Basically, in 1965, educational psychologist Bruce Tuckman created Tuckman's model of group development. And if you've done any management training courses in the last 50 years, then you'll have heard of it because it's still in use today. But interestingly, these group dynamics that he talks about aren't limited to the workplace. In virtually every disaster movie, Tuckman's model has been used to great effect. And it basically says that there's 4 stages to group dynamics. And I'm sure you've heard of forming, storming, norming and performing. And that's basically the theory that my trainer believed, and I believe him, that is what makes a great disaster movie. So the first stage is forming, and that's where people from different backgrounds are thrown together. And whilst they agree on the ultimate goal, which in a film is usually to escape the burning building they're in, the sinking ship, the dinosaur-infested island, whatever. But in the forming stage, they tend to work independently. Their primary goal is their own safety, and they're mistrustful of everybody else. But as they get to know each other, they then move into the storming stage, and this is where they start to form opinions of the other team members, and we see lots of arguments and power struggles as they challenge authority or whoever has chosen themselves as the leader. And through that storming phase, you move then into norming, which is where the disagreements start to get resolved and the team become closer. They're more focused on working cooperatively. They start to know each other's role and the responsibilities within the group, and the team start to work better together. And finally, they move then into the performing stage. And this is where everyone's comfortable with their role and they're focused on the success of the mission rather than their own success. And it enables a high level of performance, ultimately getting them off the godforsaken island, defeating the alien mothership or escaping the collapsing tunnel. You can take virtually any disaster film from the 1970s onwards and you can put this 4-stage group dynamic into it. And the example that we were given was the Poseidon Adventure. And we talked about how they absolutely start in the forming stage because nobody knows each other. They're all just thrown together because of this disaster on board the ship. The storming stage is where there are a few of them who all think that they should be the leader and they start to have battles over which way they should go and things like that. Then they start to perform together and then they get into the performing stage where they ultimately save themselves. Put that together with big scale, and that's what makes a great disaster movie. It's about group dynamics and it's about scale. So all of these ones that are now throwing lots and lots of CGI at them, that's what I think makes a great disaster movie, and that's what CGI is for. Use it to make an earthquake look real, to make a whole city collapse. That's what I'm interested in CGI for. That's my view of what makes a great disaster movie.
Wow. One interesting point I'd just like to draw from that, which is a theory that I had, is that a lot of disaster movies, they're obviously about humanity, as you've just pointed out, Gordon, and they kind of present at the same time both a positive and negative outlook of humanity. Mm. Positive, because, like you say, you bring all these people from different backgrounds and cultures, rich and poor, and they ultimately work together. But the negative thing, of course, is that it takes some terrible disaster or something where people are literally thrown together and they don't have a choice for this actually to happen. And in normal life, unfortunately, a lot of the time it doesn't happen like that. So yeah, I think Gordon's pretty much summed up what makes a good disaster movie there. Does anyone else have anything to add, Simon?
Suspense, action, heroes, because it needs obviously a combination of that kind of 3 ingredients. You know, a bit of suspense to build up to the disaster, getting to know the characters, the action of the actual disaster occurring, hopefully with great effects. Even I think some of the 70s films still had good effects for their time. But then you also get a group of survivors. There'll be some people that survive. They all band together. A leader will emerge. Although some will be lost along the way, which normally happens, most of the group will always emerge safe from the disaster and live happily ever after. Well, until the next disaster comes along, of course.
Does anyone have anything to add about what they love in particular about disaster movies?
Well,
Matt?
I think a lot was said there about the group dynamic, about people coming together. Basically, that's the heroes, but the other side of it is the villains, of which in most disaster movies, there's two types of villain. The first one is the disaster itself. So obviously, the arrival of the big villain, i.e. the earthquake or the tsunami or the alien invasion, the build-up to that, as Simon said, the suspense, the anticipation is a big part of the film. But there's almost always a human villain in it as well. There'll always be some guy who's just out for himself. And of course, they always end up getting killed by the disaster at some point. I watched San Andreas recently, and there's a character that does something pretty nasty early on in the film. He's not a very nice chap, and a shipping container lands on him on the Golden Gate Bridge later on in the film. So, you know, the disaster has its revenge on the little villains. So I like that bit of a disaster movie.
Simon, what do you love about disaster movies?
Well, I just think everyone loves a good disaster, to be honest. We love seeing humanity in peril, cities destroyed, planes crashing, ships sinking. You know, it's a natural inbuilt fascination, I would put it. One might say bloodlust to a lesser extent to see us in trouble. We just obviously wouldn't want these things to happen to us in real life. It seems to satisfy our inbuilt natural animal instincts, cause trouble or enjoy it happening to other fellow people, only in film form. But the fact that we don't see these type of scenarios in real life that often, thank God, tends to heighten our interest in the films, I think, themselves. I'll sort of sum it up with an example of why do people like disaster movies? Well, why do people like rubbernecking at accidents on motorways? Sort of says it all, really.
Thank you. So, Gordon, what are your thoughts then?
For me, I think it's the human instinct to build things up and knock them down. It's always fun, especially, to see symbols of the establishment, like the Houses of Parliament or the White House, being blown to bits. But there's also something oddly satisfying about something you love being totally obliterated, a bit like the bloodlust that Simon talks of. But more than that, for me, it's the underdog spirit. It's the winning against the odds, in the worst circumstances, never giving up when all seems lost. It's that ultimate symbol of hope. And I think there's nothing better than a disaster movie to make you believe in hope.
Thank you, Gordon. Yeah, that pretty much sums up my feeling as well. Obviously, the spectacular is always great as well, like you mentioned earlier. So yeah, that's why we love disaster movies then. We'll move on now to the first of our subcategories, which is man versus nature. So these are the disaster movies where man is pitted against nature. Nature of its own accord threatens mankind. So we're thinking here floods, earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, and so on. Obviously, quite a few examples in this particular genre. My first thought really is as to the best or most exciting type of natural disaster. Mine has always been the tsunami. This has probably stemmed from my love of the Poseidon Adventure, which is one of the first disaster movies I would have seen, which was a tsunami which was caused by an underground earthquake. So it's actually two disasters, I suppose you could say, in one. And this huge tidal wave causes the Poseidon, which is a massive cruise liner, to turn over in the ocean and is turned upside down. And thanks to lots of air pockets inside it, there's a few survivors left in there who must decide what to do, whether to make their way to one part of the ship or the other and hope that they're rescued at some point. So the tsunami has always been my favourite, and it's been played out in several films since, most notably the aforementioned San Andreas. So over to you guys, what's your most exciting type of natural disaster or favourite of this subgenre, Matt?
I honestly don't know. I don't have a particular favourite natural disaster. It's more about the film than the disaster. I think the disaster alone doesn't make the film. It's how people react to the disaster and what devastation the disaster causes. So I'm going to sit on the fence, just not if there's an earthquake.
Simon?
Well, I agree with you, Graham. For me, the best sort of natural disaster is the earthquakes, followed up naturally with a tsunami. Using 2012 as an example, the Earth's core, due to a solar flare, was getting warmer, and it set off these powerful earthquakes all around the world, which in turn set off powerful tsunamis. And I just think the combination of both of those, especially how far the tsunami came into the land, that image of when the aircraft carrier, the USS John F. Kennedy, is literally washed up onto the American continent, it landed on the White House, killing the president and all that. So pretty much the top natural disaster, obviously the film has to be pretty good as well, and I actually quite like 2012. It's just, you know, you see the city's destroyed, and they think, oh, well, that's pretty bad. And then next minute, you've got 200-foot tidal waves hitting the place. So I think that combination of both is pretty impressive, pretty powerful stuff.
Thank you, Simon. Gordon?
This sounds almost like a big verbal group hug, because I'm pretty similar to you guys in that earthquakes for me are kind of the most exciting. It's the terraforming qualities of an earthquake that make for the most amazing scenes in films. And that's why I mentioned earlier about CGI being great for the disaster movie, because you can see whole cities crumble. There are plenty of other disasters that just don't have that visual image that an earthquake can have. And a great example was in 2012, where you've got John Cusack in this light aircraft with the other people, and they're taking off down this makeshift runway, and they're trying to get up in the air, and the ground is just falling away beneath them. And they just get up in the air just before the road disappears and the whole city collapses. And it's just a fantastic scene. So I think earthquakes are by far the most exciting of.
Okay, guys, which natural disaster movie would you least like to get caught up in? Matt?
I think the Poseidon Adventure has got to be the worst one, because if you're in an earthquake, there's a chance you can hide somewhere and the rubble's not going to land on you. You're not going to get swallowed up by the earth. Same if you're in a tornado, even a volcano, you can probably escape from it if you're pretty resourceful. But being stuck upside down in a boat and not knowing whether to go up or down, I think that's probably the worst situation to be caught in.
Okay. Fair enough. Gordon, what are your thoughts?
I think a Twister would be pretty high on the list for me, and Twister the film kind of shows that. Unless you live somewhere with a lot of subterranean hideouts, you're pretty much screwed. So in London, you'd be all right if a Twister hits, get straight into the underground and you'll be fine. But in Halifax, I'd be whisked off to the Land of Oz before I could find a pub with a basement. So yeah, Twister for me, because there's just nowhere to hide unless you can get underground.
I must admit, I'm with Matt. I think it would be absolutely horrible to call in a ship that's turned upside down, and the feeling of claustrophobia as well, and not knowing which way to go and how to escape. And ultimately, your escape lies in the hands of someone else. You know, you're not in control of it, because how are you going to get out the top of the ship? I think in the end there was a hatch or something that they could climb out of, but it was extremely difficult to get to. And I just think that that sort of movie where there is no way of knowing which way to go and which way's safe, it's an absolute horrible situation to be caught in.
What if there's no Christmas tree for you to climb up as well?
That's true, yeah. What happens if Roddy McDowell's not there? Simon, any thoughts?
Of the film, I'd probably say Airport 77. I know that's not a natural disaster, but the part of the film that is natural is that the way the jumbo jet is sunk onto the seabed, and drowning is a real fear that I, you know, dying isn't great anyway, but drowning is something I've always had a fear of, and I just think anything to do with water, again, like Poseidon Adventure, anything where you'd be stuck in somewhere where the water's rising up and you can't get away from it. I know they eventually did get out of the plane, but you didn't know that for most of the film, so... All right, it's a technology disaster, but then it becomes a natural disaster because it's stuck on the bottom of the seabed. The plane starts leaking, things are going to happen. They could end up drowning, and I just think drowning is the thing that I'd hate pretty much out of anything. So, yeah, anything to do with drowning for me.
Okay, thank you, Simon. So on to our next subheading for disaster movies, and it's man versus man or technology. This is about movies where man's own creations go wrong, so anything involving aircraft, ships, submarines, or man against himself, terrorist attacks, or possibly nuclear related as well. Anything kind of under this banner is the sort of movies we're talking about now. So you've got from the past movies such as The Hindenburg, which is about obviously the tragic explosion of the airship. And obviously this will cover also all the airplane movies such as the Airport series. Titanic, of course, the huge so-called unsinkable ship, which sank. And also other movies such as The Day After Tomorrow, which although is primarily about weather and the coming of a rather swift ice age, the ice age itself is caused by global warming, caused by man himself. So what are our thoughts on these type of movies? Many of these are based on real events. The most recent one I've watched was World Trade Center, which is obviously about the 2001 terrorist attacks. I've got some thoughts on that, which I'll come to in a minute, but obviously these are quite traumatic events. Is it appropriate to make movies of these, and is it okay to change what happens in them for the dramatic impetus or whatever they need to do for these movies? Simon, what do you think?
Man-made technology, obviously, whether it be transport or whatever kind of thing that man has made, is always going to be an inherent failure in it somewhere, which is going to cause accidents. Nuclear holocaust and war of any kind will always be inherently a failure, because it's we with people failing by using that stuff. To change the story with a bit of poetic license for a feature film, whether to make it more watchable or more or less realistic, depending on the premise of the film, is probably fine. I don't see any reason why you can't sort of fit a bit of extra story in around it, like Titanic with all the bit at the start. Personally, I need to watch it from when it hits the iceberg, but it can be done, and it makes the film watchable, and obviously they want the audience to watch the films and make the money out of it. So
Simon, what you're saying is you watch Titanic after she gets her babs out.
No, I quickly watch that and then flip on.
Right, okay. Just.
Ooh, I was worried there for a minute.
That would have been a disaster.
Gordon, what are your thoughts on this?
In terms of whether you should be able to change the story, of course. We're talking about artistic license. Some of the greatest disasters in the world would be really dull if they just told you how it happened. Documentaries are fine. Documentaries are supposed to be slightly dull and informative. But we're talking about fiction based on fact, and absolutely you should be able to change them. But it's important not to forget the tragedy that actually happened, inspired by true events, absolutely fine by me. And in terms of how long we should wait, well, United 93 was less than 2 years, was it, after the...
Five, I've just been looking them up.
5 years, was it 5 years?
Yeah, both were done in 2006, so it's 5 years.
Right.
Well, World Trade Center.
I'm surprised to hear they were that long after 9/11, and we certainly knew they were making those films at least a year, 2 years before, and it didn't feel too soon. These felt like stories that needed to be told, and sometimes, whilst it's a major tragedy, the stories and tales of ultimate human sacrifice, and it's the kind of human stories that we need to hear, because if we didn't and we only heard about the tragedy of these events, then it'd be a horrible world we'd live in. So thank God for films like World Trade Center and United 93 coming out reasonably close to give us some kind of hope after these tragedies.
Yeah, I think United 93 is an interesting one, because obviously a lot of what the film says happened is speculation, because no one really knows what happened to a great extent on board the aircraft in its final time. But World Trade Center, whilst no doubt an accurate depiction of what happened on 9/11, because I think it was released so soon after the events, maybe it wasn't quite as sharp as it could have been with regards to the reasons for the attacks and so forth. It didn't bring much political side to it. Maybe people would argue that they didn't really need to. It was more about the disaster itself and how people responded to that. But it's an excellent film still, I think, and it doesn't really gloss over too much. And because it's an event which we have not only lived through but is kind of still relatively fresh in our minds, I think that it means a lot more to us to watch something about this, and we can all remember that day back in 2001, and to watch a movie dramatise it is so powerful. And I think it's, like you say, Gordon, it's vitally important that movies continue to do this. And, you know, if a little bit of dramatic license has to be used to make the film flow better, then so be it. But as long as the central message remains intact, I don't see any issue with that. Matt, have you got any further thoughts?
Yeah, I think I differ a little bit. I've watched United 93 and I think that's a great film. It's not a disaster movie. It's a film about some people doing their bit for their country in the context of the film. I imagine they're given a little bit more patriotism than some of them were actually behaving like when they were on the plane. But, you know, they deserve to be remembered, and I think a film about them deserved to be made. I'm still amazed they were made so soon afterwards, because I know 5 years is quite a long time, but America in particular is still very raw about this, and we nearly 15 years later. So it does surprise me that not only did they make the films and that people thought it was a good idea to try and make money out of these events, but also that they were reasonably well received in America. I haven't seen World Trade Center. I've just looked at the cast list on IMDb. I'm just amazed it actually stars Nicolas Cage. How any film can star Nicolas Cage and be taken seriously when it's about such a significant and tragic event amazes me, really, based on his normal movie output.
He is quite good in it, to be fair, and it's got Michael Shannon in it as well, who's very good.
He can act, he just chooses not to most of the time. I think if they're going to be based on true events, they should stick as closely to the facts as possible out of respect for the victims. And people shouldn't be making shitloads of money out of them, which I'm sure the producers of both those films did. That's just a little bit crass for me.
So how do you regulate that? What are you going to do? Are you going to say you're not allowed to show this film too wide? These are films and stories that most people think need to be told so we can understand about the heroes that were involved in these horrible tragedies. But how do you stop somebody making money out of that?
I don't have an answer. I just don't think that you should be...
That shouldn't be your primary goal.
Do you think their motives for making those films was to tell the story or to make money out of the fact that it's a real-life disaster?
I think often the movie company that make the film are just interested in the fast book, but the person writing the story and the people that contribute to the story are the ones who care about getting that message across. I completely agree with you that it's crass, but I don't see how it could be any other way.
No, I don't have an answer for how it could be any other way. I just question whether it was the right thing to do in the first place, I guess. Titanic was fine, because that's a 100-year-old disaster. I don't know, the 9/11 things. We all probably sat there and watched the TV for hours on end when it happened, and I think that was enough for me.
Didn't you watch that thinking you wish you knew more about the people behind it and the people in the Twin Towers and what they did and what was going through people's minds?
Is World Trade Center based on true events, or is it just dramatized based on true events? You know, is it about the real people?
Well, as far as I'm aware, it's based on real stories.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know either way. It's obviously based on true events. How factually accurate it is, I don't know. If it's not telling a story about a specific person in that disaster that was real, then I don't know why anyone would want to watch it. Whereas United 93, while the facts of it might be a bit more open to interpretation, it's telling a real story about real people that, as far as we know, brought that plane down to prevent it hitting the White House. So,
okay, so on to our next subtopic, and we are now on to man versus monsters or epidemics. Whether it's zombies, monsters, or the Ebola virus, here we have the disaster movies that contain mass epidemics, arguably the most dangerous of disaster movie, as they often threaten entire mankind. So, the first question I'm going to throw out here to you guys is, we've touched upon it earlier, actually, with the trailer choice of Matt's. Have we reached crisis point when it comes to the zombie disaster movie? There's been so many of these, not just movies, of course, but games and books as well. Myself, that I'm starting to get a little bit weary of this. We've had the Resident Evil films. We've had, obviously, the originals, such as Night of the Living Dead and 28 Days Later, etc., etc. Have we reached breaking point with these? Why are they still trying to make more? And is there anywhere for the genre to go? Gordon, do you want to go first on this?
I already said earlier, I think we've absolutely reached saturation point. I reached my personal saturation point probably 5 years ago. As I said, the one film that's actually done something different was Maggie, and I've not seen anything game, film or book-wise that's really interested me since. And I used to be a big fan of the zombie film, and it's a shame that I've become so militantly against it. So yeah, absolute saturation, and I'd like them to put me in a time capsule for 25 years.
Matt, are you along the same lines?
Yeah, pretty much. I do watch the occasional movie of this type, but I don't watch many of them. You know, I've seen Night of the Living Dead, I've seen Dawn of the Dead, I've seen the remake of Dawn of the Dead. Those films, they all follow the same plot. You know, 28 days later, 28 weeks later, zombies might move fast or slow. They might not be zombies. They might be infected with a virus or a fungus or whatever, but they're all pretty much the same thing. I am a big fan of The Walking Dead TV show, but that's not really about the zombie apocalypse and hasn't been since about the third season. It's about the people that are left behind, and the zombies are almost inconsequential for the most part. They kill them nonchalantly. They just walk past them and stab them in the head or put a bullet in the head, and the zombies cause no danger to them. So that's moved on to be a post-apocalyptic soap opera almost, rather than a zombie apocalypse story.
Simon, are you fed up with zombies as well?
No, I'm not really, because I'm not a fan of them anyway, and I've not watched a lot of zombie films, to be honest. This may have been a factor in why I thought the film Maggie with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, playing a character that is completely unlike anything he's played before, to me was what a good zombie film was about. It focused hardly any about the zombie outbreak, but rather a father dealing with the gradual breakdown of his daughter's body's immune system succumbing to the virus. There wasn't a lot of action scene with zombies attacking people, and it was more about the love between a father and his daughter. Maybe filmmakers have started to think it's a saturated genre themselves, maybe start approaching it from a different angle. I don't think it's a genre that's going to go away, though, to be honest. I think Hollywood still likes zombies and that kind of direction.
Yeah, you're probably right, I fear. What about this other type of disaster movie under this heading, sort of virus outbreaks or plagues? There's quite a few examples of this. The notable one I can think of, and a film which I still enjoy, is Outbreak, which is obviously about the Ebola virus. But there are lots of other examples as well, such as Contagion and the Andromeda Strain. What are your thoughts on these guys, Matt?
Well, I watched Contagion recently, and that was an interesting film. It was pretty grim stuff, but it very much focuses on how the virus perpetuates itself across the world. So rather than there's a virus and we need to stop it, there's a virus. Where did it start from and who's most likely to have contracted it? And in some of the early scenes, it focuses very much on how it's transferred from one person to another. It basically originates with Gwyneth Paltrow, pretty much, and she's an international businesswoman, so it's who she transmits it to and who they transmit it to. And there's scenes that just make you think that you'll never touch anything in a public place again, because someone will touch like a pole on a bus and then the next person will touch it and they'll get the virus. So it makes you think about how easily this stuff could be transmitted if something as virulent as this particular outbreak actually got out there, you know, how quickly it could get around the world. I'm not a massive fan of those kind of films, but that was an interesting film, just focusing more on the virus than the people involved with it, really.
Thank you, Matt. Gordon?
I think films often portray it in a very, what seems really realistic. And I think it's quite horrifying when you think about what's possible from a chemical kind of perspective. And the next Dan Brown film, Inferno, is another good example of a viral threat movie. And I think that's kind of a sub-disaster genre in its own, this viral threat. And I think it's becoming more and more of a worry in the real world. And that makes for the films be more and more exciting. Zombie films very rarely make you stop and think, you know, that could actually happen. But if you take away the fact that it brings the dead back to life again, the actual propagation of the virus is really, really possible, and more than possible, it's actually very likely. So yeah, I'm quite a fan of the viral outbreak film, just not of the ones that turn the dead into the living.
Some interesting points there. Does anyone have anything else they want to add to this?
I think a deadly viral outbreak is almost a certainty at some point in the future. Who knows what they're picking up in top secret labs all over the world. Terrorist attacks could use this deadly virus as real possibilities. The general accidental release of a virus that's actually been developed for good cause. Even an outbreak of a violent strain of normal diseases like pneumonia or an infectious cancer, which could bring humanity to its knees. Remember films I'm Legend, when it's just pretty much everything's wiped out, or just do a strain of like a pneumonia or a virus of just a standard sort which should be dealt with by drugs. Mutations of animals and creatures also a possibility, like Storm Godzilla, etc. But I think human pandemic is more likely. Not to say mutated creatures do not make a good disaster movie subject, of course.
That's a good point. And if you then translate that to a non-disaster movie, so we've gone through the Alien quadrilogy and we've done the review for the website, so we've all watched those. You've got something that's got the potential to wipe out the whole of the human race. But then you've got people who want to use that for military terms or medical or whatever. And you've got the riskiest thing in the world, but people don't want it destroyed. They want to keep it. They want to use it. And I think that's really interesting, that if we then seriously think about, if one of these crazy nations that are hell-bent on ruining the world comes up with some virus, would the Americans want that virus destroyed, or would they want to use it for themselves?
Okay, is there anything else to add? We haven't talked much about monster movies. I think probably the best example here is Jurassic Park, whether you call that a disaster movie. It's quite limited in its scope, but of course you've got this island where there's dinosaurs running around and things going wrong. I suppose another famous one is Godzilla. Anyone got any particular favourites here?
Jurassic Park, definitely. I think that's a fantastic example of a non-standard disaster movie, because it's absolutely a disaster movie. It's a towering inferno, but it's an island that's on fire with dinosaurs. It's an absolutely brilliant film. Unfortunately, they got to a point where they couldn't work out how to expand on that without making it shit. I know people will disagree about Jurassic World, but I was not a fan of that. And I feel like Jurassic Park is an untapped world of disaster movies that they've just not managed to do anything with yet. Michael Crichton's book goes so far beyond what's in the film, but the film still does a fantastic job of it. But in terms of monsters in general, that's not really for me. I'm more into the real world kind of stuff. But Jurassic Park made it feel like it was real world because there was science behind this. You get these prehistoric flies that have got this DNA, and that might actually work. And my tiny brain believes it. So I loved the fact that they tried to make the science believable. So Jurassic Park, brilliant. Monster movies, crap.
Okay, Simon?
The thing I just sort of found a bit interesting is what I would call a disaster movie sort of turned around the other way is Planet of the Apes, and the fact that we've made a mess of the planet and everything else, and another species has risen up and taken over. But that's, I think, more to do with mankind's mistakes with the gorillas. But I just find that as a sort of thing that is a sort of disaster in the fact that we're now not the dominant species on the planet because of our shortcomings and apocalyptic nature. And the apes have taken over, sort of just turning it around a little bit. But obviously not technically a disaster movie, I suppose.
Thanks, guys. Our final subtopic is man versus space or other miscellaneous threats. So this is threats that will come from the outer space, whether they be giant balls of rock or aliens, and also anything else we think that would be called a disaster movie that we haven't covered already. So there's a lot of notable examples here, most prominently in the late 90s when Hollywood was getting into this habit of pitching two movies against each other. We had the Bruce Willis action fest Armageddon, and we also had Deep Impact. And you've also obviously got any other movies that are set in outer space which involve disasters of some kind, such as, for instance, Meteor, which was another asteroid movie, of course, Gravity, and anything to do with aliens coming to the Earth and trying to conquer or oppress the human race, such as Independence Day or War of the Worlds, or indeed anything else we can think of that we haven't covered already. So first of all, going back to my first thoughts there, one of my favourite types of film is the asteroid movie, which follows a template. Like, there's an asteroid, there's loads of them out there, according to the bods that know these sort of things, and the chances are you would have thought that eventually one of them is going to hit the Earth again, and these sort of events, obviously depending on the size of the asteroid, could pretty much end mankind for one reason or the other, because if an asteroid of big enough size hits the Earth, it's not just the impact that it has to start off with, but it's also all the dust and the dirt that it would throw up into the atmosphere. You'd basically get the effects of a nuclear winter, and there'd be no sunlight, which would pretty much exterminate life as well. It's quite an evocative type of disaster movie because there's obviously a lot of potential there for lots of special effects, etc. So Matt, what are your thoughts on the asteroid movie?
When they both came out, I was a big fan of both of those films, Deep Impact and Armageddon. I watched Armageddon again recently. I haven't watched Deep Impact recently. I think Deep Impact was probably the better of the two in retrospect. I think Armageddon was, well, it's a Bruckheimer production, Michael Bay film, isn't it? So it's got lots of heroes and lots of explosions, but actually it's pretty bloody awful based on my recent watching it. It's quite embarrassingly bad and so stupid. I mean, they've got these two super-powered space shuttles and they decide to try and land both of them on the asteroid at the same time, which seems a bit of a silly thing to do when, if they both crash, then you've got no backup plan. So anyway, the question about could it happen, it definitely could happen. The question is, could we do anything about it? And based on those films, there's the theory that you could land on it or fire a nuclear missile at it. Whether that would work, whether it would make any difference, I don't know. I think if one of them's going to hit us, would we be better off knowing about it, or would we be better off living in ignorance and just waiting for the disaster to occur? But they're fun films, and as you say, they open themselves up to lots of space-based special effects sequences, as well as the destruction of famous landmarks with the sort of precursor meteors hitting the Earth as well.
Simon, what are your thoughts on asteroid movies?
I've seen both those, yeah. I thought they were pretty much okay. I think obviously an asteroid hitting the Earth is pretty much the most likely realistic earth-shattering